This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, the 2nd of June, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in LA, I'm Ara Bogado. Six world powers agreed to a proposal to Iran offering incentives in exchange for the country to end its uranium enrichment. The British Parliament considers a proposal that would allow the imprisonment of so-called deserters for life. And we'll take a look at U.S.-supported Mogadishu warlords. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Carbon dioxide emissions have reached an all-time high, according to new data from the UN Climate Secretariat in Bonn, Germany. The United States, responsible for the overwhelming majority of greenhouse gas emissions, has broken a new record by releasing just over 7 billion tons of greenhouse gases in 1 year. Armed men have kidnapped 8 Western oil workers in Nigeria's Niger Delta region. Sema Lakoya reports from Lagos.
6 of the kidnapped oil workers are from Britain, while the other 2 are from the United States and Canada. About 40 gunmen in boats kidnapped the oil workers early Friday morning at an offshore oil rig near the Nigerian coast. The rig is operated by Fred Olsen Energy, a Norwegian oil company. A presidential spokesman says the kidnapping is the result of a disagreement between local communities and the oil company. In recent months, there has been growing anger in local communities in the Niger Delta against Western oil companies operating in the region. Local communities accuse Western oil companies of polluting their land and denying them a share of the billions of dollars made yearly from oil sales. The growing anger has culminated in the abduction of foreign oil workers. This is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
A massive pro-Maoist rally took place in Nepal today, the first of its kind since the country agreed to a ceasefire a month ago. Carrie Byron has more.
More than 200,000 people showed up in the center of the capital today for a rally organized by Nepal's Maoist rebels. The vast majority were not from within the Kathmandu Valley itself, but rather from many of the outlying areas of the country. Hundreds of overloaded buses, which rebels had hijacked yesterday, were seen ferrying around jubilant Maoist cadres in bright red t-shirts specially printed for today's event. Reports also surfaced, however, of many villagers being forced to make the journey to the capital as a show of support. Meanwhile, normal traffic was nearly halted, while hundreds of additional armed police personnel were brought into the capital, and the newly renamed Nepal Army staked out the royal palace. Technically, the tight security should not be necessary. 1 week ago today, negotiating teams for the Maoists and the new democratic government met for the first time since 2003 and hammered out a 25-point agreement for code of conduct during the ceasefire. Prominently listed as number 2 is that neither party shall, quote, mobilize, display, or use their armed forces in a manner that could spread fear and terror amongst the people. At similar rallies that took place around the country earlier this week, however, that point was reportedly already broken. Carrie Byron, Kathmandu.
In Chile, the government has issued a proposal in response to the demands of striking high school students. In Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garretón has the story.
More than 400 students from throughout Chile are meeting in an assembly to study the government response to their demands. On a national televised address to the nation last night, President Michelle Bachelet gave her government response to high school students who have been on strike for over 2 weeks. The government gave in to most of the students' demands. Bachelet said the government will issue a free national bus pass, pay for nearly all students to take university entrance exams, increase government subsidies to poor families, and create a broad commission to discuss changes to the Education Act so that it would guarantee their right to an education. After studying the government response, the students are expected to meet with the Minister of Education to let the government know if they accept the proposal or if they will continue negotiating on issues. If an agreement is not reached, the students have called for a national strike Monday. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
In Oaxaca, Mexico, public school teachers are mobilizing against a package of education reforms that would privatize the public education system and drastically reduce the teaching of history to Mexican students. Vladimir Flores reports from Oaxaca City.
Mexican public school teachers have been on a strike for almost 2 weeks. Tens of thousands of teachers have completely occupied the state capital of Oaxaca, setting up tents and sleeping in the streets and plazas of the city center. During a massive march today, At least 50,000 teachers and their allies demanded greater resources for public education from the state and federal governments. Although the teachers received support from campesino groups, indigenous organizations, and other activists, their mobilizations are opposed by business leaders, local politicians, and most mainstream media. This morning, political leaders issued an ultimatum to the teachers to either abandon their occupation of the city center or face eviction by security forces. Vladimir Flores, Oaxaca City, Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Six world powers have agreed to a proposal to Iran that offers incentives in exchange for abandoning its uranium enrichment. The deal, whose details will be kept secret until Iran has seen the proposals, is expected to end a diplomatic standoff. Meanwhile, U.S. Intelligence Chief Negroponte said in an interview today that within 10 years, Iran will possess a nuclear bomb. Anastasia Genetsditska has more from Washington, D.C.
The British Foreign Secretary Margaret Beckett delivered this announcement today, in which she emphasized that it is very important not to threaten Iran.
I'm pleased to say that we have agreed a set of far-reaching proposals as a basis for discussion with Iran. We believe that they offer Iran the chance to reach a negotiated agreement based on cooperation. We are prepared to resume negotiation should Iran resume the suspension of all enrichment-related and reprocessing activities as required by the IAEA, and we would also suspend action in the Security Council. We urge Iran to take the positive path and to consider seriously our substantive proposals, which would bring significant benefits to Iran.
This incentive proposal follows U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's meeting with foreign ministers from Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia in Vienna, Austria, the headquarters of the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency. In the meantime, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov announced on Russian TV that the Vienna Accords meant that the use of military force was ruled out. He also praised the achieved agreements.
Мы рассчитываем на то, что Иран откликнется на этот призыв, что Иран сядет за стол переговоров.
We hope Iran will respond to our appeal and start negotiations. It is a principal matter that these negotiations offer came from all six states, including the United States, for which this is no doubt a difficult step. Analysts state that for Russia, these agreements are a major relief, since Russia is unwilling to ruin its relationships with the US and EU by openly helping Iran. Beckett's announcement came as former weapons inspector Hans Blix submitted a report to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, stating that Iran should stop its uranium enrichment program, but it probably won't. The Blix Commission, whose work was paid for largely by the Swedish government and the private Canadian-based Simons Foundation, also stated that Iran should not be singled out and that nations like Saudi Arabia, Syria, Egypt, and Israel should also be included in a weapons-free zone. Director of the U.S. National Intelligence, John Negroponte, told BBC Radio today that Tehran could have a nuclear bomb ready between 2010 and 2015.
They seem to be determined, that is our assessment, that they are determined to develop nuclear weapons.
How far are they from a bomb?
Well, this is a matter of assessment. We don't have a clear-cut knowledge, but the estimate that we have made is that sometime between the beginning of the next decade and the middle of the next decade, they might be in a position to have a nuclear weapon, which is a cause of great concern.
European diplomats will present the proposal to Iran, and it will have weeks to respond. So far, Iranian officials kept silent about the Vienna Accords, whereas Iranian TV dismissed it as containing no new proposals. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezditska in Washington, D.C.
The number of allegations of U.S. troops deliberately killing Iraqi civilians continues to mount. Last night, the BBC broadcast footage from an incident in March in which U.S. soldiers were accused of executing 11 Iraqis, including 4 children. The U.S. military says it was hunting an al-Qaeda suspect, but the Iraqi police maintain U.S. soldiers rounded up and executed an entire family in a house which they then demolished. FSRN's Aaron Glantz and Salam Talib report.
The BBC didn't broadcast all the tape in its possession, calling it too gruesome for television. But they said the video showed all 11 Iraqis killed, from a 75-year-old grandmother to a 6-month-old baby, were killed by bullet wounds to the head and stomach. Iraqi policemen told the network that after everyone was shot, the U.S. military bombed the house.
There are many, many, many stories, like Haditha, still undercover and need to be highlighted in Iraq.
Dr. Salam Ismail is projects manager for the organization Doctors for Iraq and former chief of the junior doctors in Baghdad's medical city. He was providing medical care in the western Iraqi city of Haditha when U.S. soldiers killed 24 Iraqis in their home last November. He says during the same assault, the U.S. military attacked the hospital and burned the pharmacy.
You can imagine the city of Haditha, especially in the hospital, have been attacked 3 times and destroyed the medical stores and all departments in it in one of these attacks and have been occupied. And also in November 2005 by the American and Iraqi army for 7 days, which is a severe breach of Geneva Conventions. In one of these attacks, the hospital had been sieged for 3 hours and end with using live ammunition inside it and handcuffing all doctors and destroying and burning the medical store, all with the content of medical store burned by this random shooting, and ending with killing one of the patients in his bed. And we have the name and age of that patient also.
In Baghdad Thursday, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki told reporters violence against civilians by occupying troops is common in Iraq. He added, many soldiers have, quote, no respect for citizens, smashing civilian cars and killing on a suspicion or a hunch. At the Pentagon, Major General William Caldwell disagreed.
The coalition does not and it will not tolerate any unethical or criminal behavior. Any allegations of such activities will be fully investigated, and any members found to have committed these violations will be held accountable.
John Oliveira was a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Navy and a spokesman for an aircraft carrier battle group until he resigned in disgust in 2004.
They're using the media to turn it into a justice issue, not a policy issue.
Oliveira says, as with most cases, the Bush administration first tried to ignore the allegations, then denied the acts occurred. When the evidence became overwhelming, the Pentagon promised a thorough investigation. He says it's the same spin as during the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, after which numerous low-ranking soldiers were put on trial, but the upper echelons of the Pentagon remained unscathed.
All of a sudden, the Pentagon has admitted there's issues, the administration has admitted their issues, that they're going to get to the bottom of this. So now all of a sudden, the administration is on the side of the Iraqis who said that this happened, and they need to lend some credibility with the American public that, hey, we are taking responsibility for this. We aren't hiding anything. What they're failing to mention is that they did hide this for several months. The administration is using this to get the picture away from them, the Pentagon, put it on the Marines, and put it on, especially on those young Marines that will almost guaranteed will be taken to trial. But I will almost guarantee that none of their leadership will be taken to trial, or at most they'll get a letter of reprimand and it in their service records.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Salam Talib.
A proposal for an armed forces bill is currently working its way through Britain's parliament, which would pave the way to imprison so-called deserters for life. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
The number of soldiers absconding from the British Army has trebled since the invasion of Iraq. Section 8 of this proposed legislation tightens definition of so-called desertion, now also targeting those who go absent without leave from a military occupation of a foreign country or territory. Gwyn Gwinterfer of support group At Ease for members of the military has advised soldiers in this position.
When people are desperate, they will leave a desperate situation. These are highly principled people. They are very brave people. They are people who would never have gone absent if they were not convinced that this particular posting is wrong. And whatever the penalty, for them going absent, they've wrecked a military career that in many cases was very precious to them.
Those who find themselves in similar positions may now face life imprisonment. It's also an offence for any member of the British Armed Forces to give interviews to journalists, unless it's with permission from and in the presence of a Ministry of Defence official. According to the support group At Ease, even those who've left the armed forces are under intense pressure. In this excerpt from the Telegraph newspaper, read by Free Speech Radio News, one soldier explains why he resigned after coming back from Iraq.
I had reservations about going out to Iraq before I went, but as a soldier, you just get on with what you are ordered to do. I found that when I was out in Iraq, I couldn't keep my views separate from my work without compromising my role as a soldier. It was at that stage that I knew I couldn't carry on. I was very angry, and still am, at the way the politicians in this country and in America have lied to the British public about the war. But most importantly, I didn't join the British Army to conduct American foreign policy. I think the war in Iraq is a war of aggression and is morally wrong.
Michael Kalmanovitz of the men's peace network Payday, working with Global Women's Strike, has campaigned for military reform and against this armed forces bill.
They've introduced a couple of things that really increases the possibility of a military occupation on the one hand, and undermines the possibility that soldiers will be able to say, I refuse illegal and immoral orders. Specifically, this bill mentions military occupation of a foreign country or territory, which is an expression they've never used before in military legislation. The previous defense secretary wanted to rewrite the Geneva Convention in order to legalize preemptive military action. Their intention is to go to war more often and more viciously. Preemptive war was what the Nazis did.
The bill was passed without problems by members of Parliament and is now being considered by the House of Lords, which has the power to amend it and send it back to the House of Commons to be reconsidered. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
In Beirut, a comedy skit by a right-wing Christian director mocking Hezbollah leader Nasrallah caused sectarian tensions to boil over as angry Hezbollah supporters took to the streets. Emily Disha Becker and Jamal Gosen report.
Late Thursday night, thousands of Lebanese Shia took to the streets of Beirut to protest a comedy show mocking Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. Women, children, and men spontaneously poured into the streets of Beirut's southern suburbs shortly after the program aired on the Christian TV station LBC. As they made their way towards central Beirut, some youth set fire to tires, smashed cars, and set up roadblocks on two major motorways. According to Vivian Vrali, a resident of a nearby Christian area,
they attacked with knives and poles. For 2 hours, they burned tires and yelled until the army took control.
One of the skits showed a character wearing a black turban and glasses resembling the Hezbollah leader. The lookalike mocked Hezbollah's reasons for keeping its weapons and ridiculed the group's insistence on continuing its resistance against Israel, which still occupies the contested Shebaa farms along the border. Hezbollah's arms are a contentious issue in light of international pressure on the group to disarm. Hassan Schumann, the head of the Shia Bashura municipality in Beirut.
The show mocked a religious figure and the symbol of our resistance, and that makes us feel insulted. Khalil uses the cover of comedy to smear the image of Nasrallah for political goals.
While some demonstrators expressed outrage at the satirizing of a religious figure who is considered the most influential leader in Lebanon today, underlying political and sectarian tensions contributed to the unrest. The TV station LBC, which broadcast the skit, is associated with the Lebanese forces, a militia that collaborated with Israel during the civil war and now calls for Hezbollah's disarmament. The producer of the TV show, Sharbil Khalil, recently wrote and directed a film which was widely condemned as a Christian call to arms and an incitement to sectarian violence. While Nasrallah called for an end to the protest late last night, the spontaneous outburst of anger by Lebanon's largest confessional group worries many Christian inhabitants. Joseph, a Christian restaurant employee.
This is very wrong. The best thing for us Christians to do is leave the country. We no longer have an opinion. Only the Shia are allowed an opinion. In my opinion, Muslim and Christians can't live together.
For Free Speech Radio News, Emily Dishebecker and Jamal Khosin reporting from Beirut.
The senior U.S. diplomat who specializes in Somalia, Michael Zorich, has been removed from his post in Nairobi after expressing concerns about U.S. support for the Mogadishu warlords. The militia are loyal to a group of secular warlords who have been battling rivals accused of sheltering al-Qaeda fighters. Some 200 people have been killed in recent fighting between the groups, and as FSRN's Joshua Chalimpa reports, the militias of the Anti-Terrorism Alliance, supported by the U.S., have attacked and overrun the only hospital in the capital, and local residents have no access to health facilities.
The International Committee of the Red Cross has urged the gunmen to leave so the medical staff could continue looking after the injured. Somalia has had no effective government since the overthrow of President Siad Barre in 1991 under Islamic courts, being resisted by the US-backed Anti-Terrorism Alliance, formed the only basis of authority. Janice Omal Kaldi of the Mogadishu-based Horn of Africa Radio and TV says about 3,000 people could have died as a result of the fighting.
Six big battles inside Mogadishu took place. The official estimates, when you put together all those six battles, it's about maybe 1,000 people. But I think the death toll is far more than that. I think it is about 3,000 people. Because, you know, there are people who are buried locally. People don't go to hospitals. People are counting just those corpses who are buried publicly. But the real death toll is more than 3,000 people. This is the result of the American government together with the Somali faction leaders fighting the Islamic courts. And you know, there is this popular uprising. The Somali population have organized themselves to help Islamic courts. And in every battle, all the major six battles, the faction leaders were defeated. In fact, there are all kinds of planes over flying Mogadishu when the war is going on. And it's very clear that they are spying for the faction leaders. The Americans don't want to be seen as people breaking UN sanctions on Somali armaments.
The US has in the past tried to bring order to the Horn of Africa nation, but were forced to pull out after getting heavy casualties during the operation codenamed Operation Restore Hope. The country is also still under UN arms embargo, but the arms have continued flowing. According to Ahmed Yusuf Darwish, a UN consultant on small arms, disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration based in Hargeisa, the capital of the semi-autonomous region of Somaliland, some of the weapons in Somalia were leftover weapons from the era of the Cold War.
Actually, Somalia was the staunchest ally of the Soviet Union, and it spent a huge amount of public funds on arms. It had the strongest army in south of the Sahara. It went at war with Ethiopia over an Ogaden war, what is called Ogaden 1977-1978. The Soviet Union switched sides. It supported the government of Mengistu Haile Mariam when Ethiopia went communist. Automatically also Somalia went westwards and was supported by the Americans from 1977 till Siad Barre was overthrown. Now, the amount of arms that were available after the breakup of the state led to the current situation of everybody having arms and militias being organized and pens for hire and organized as roaming gangs of militias with no political aims.
Yusuf Darwish adds that Somalia is strategically located at the Horn of Africa and the U.S. wants to extend its influence for strategic reasons.
Now, in the current war, it's a global war against terrorism and the warlords are playing that role to the hilt. First, the bridge between Africa and the Arab world is Somalia. Since the people are African, they are Muslims. By culture and tradition, the Arabs. Their territory and proximity to the Arab Middle East is also an important issue to grapple with. It was so important in the Cold War era. It's so important to the geography of the Middle East. And if there's anything it's so interesting to the West that it has to play a big and central role and compete for influence more than the Arab countries, because if they slide much more to the Islamist or fundamentalist side, then I would assure you this is going to be the next Afghanistan.
Woman activist Alia Aden Abdi, the chairperson of the Hiran Women Action, based in the Somali capital Mogadishu, says the situation is worrying.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Every day, women and children experience tragedies, difficulties, deaths. Children can't go to schools. Health centers are closed. So if you are sick, there's nowhere to go when the war is going on. The international community must ask them to stop this and to reconcile and must help in the process of reconciliation.
Tension is still run high in the capital Mogadishu. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Cooperative businesses have become the centerpiece of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez's process towards 21st century socialism. Over 100,000 co-ops have been formed since he took office 7 years ago. Mike Fox has more from Caracas.
In mid-May, cooperative members across Venezuela celebrated the first meeting of the National Executive Cooperative Council, or CENCOP. The Cooperative Council has the difficult task of integrating Venezuela's thousands of cooperatives into a united movement. Carlos Molina, the cooperative superintendent, spoke at the plenary and described the councils.
The cooperative councils are a means of building participatory democracy used by the people organized in cooperatives in order to achieve autonomy and consolidate Venezuelan cooperativism as a social movement capable of transforming the social and economic realities of the country.
According to government statistics, there are now 600,000 people employed in the Venezuelan cooperative sector, representing 6% of the employment in the country. With more than 110,000 cooperatives, Venezuela can now boast of being the country with the most co-ops in the world, and 99% of these cooperatives have been formed under President Chavez through a very clear state policy of cooperative promotion. Although critics have expressed doubts about the sustainability of Venezuela's cooperatives, representatives say the councils are being formed to ensure their success by putting the destiny of the co-ops in the hands of their members. Antonio Galifa is a representative from the state of Falcón, where he is a member of a local corn flour pasta manufacturing cooperative.
In this moment, the creation of CENCOOP is the transfer of the power to the people themselves. The step that we are taking today is historic for the cooperative movement in Venezuela, because it is going to assume its own control and its own destiny, and we are going to know who we are and where we are headed.
The National Council meetings were attended by 140 cooperative representatives from across Venezuela. The council is composed of 5 cooperative members from each Venezuelan state, elected from local cooperatives to represent their region. During the meetings, 5 work commissions debated various proposals, such as a national cooperative bank and a national cooperative education plan. Council members also expressed interest in building ties with foreign cooperative movements, particularly with co-ops in the United States. Manuel Marino is the director of the Americas Office of the International Cooperative Alliance. He attended the meetings and was impressed by the great participation from the cooperative members, but believes they still have a long way to go.
What is going to be the role of the cooperative councils and CENCOP? How are you going to finance the cooperative councils? Are they going to be financed from the state, or are the cooperatives themselves going to finance this institution? It appears that the cooperative councils can be good, but you have to define a lot more.
While the numbers of cooperatives in this South American country continue to grow by the hundreds per week, it is clear that co-ops are making their mark. As for the future, that seems to depend on the viability of the newborn councils. Last month's meetings ended without a signed document, but with the election of a provisional commission that will meet in the following weeks to discuss the various proposals. The next general council meeting is expected within the next 3 months. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mike Fox.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.